You need a special kind of mind to rule a city like Ankh-Morpork, and Lord Vetinari had it. But then he was a special kind of person. He baffled and infuriated the lesser merchant princes, to the extent that they had long ago given up trying to assassinate him, and now merely jockeyed for position among themselves. Anyway, any assassin who tried to attack the patrician would be hard put to it to find enough flesh to insert the dagger. While other lords dined on larks stuffed with peacock's tongues, Lord Vetinari considered that a glass of boiled water and half a slice of dry bread was an elegant sufficiency. It was exasperating. He appeared to have no vice that anyone could discover. You'd have thought, with that pale, equine face, that he'd inclined towards stuff with whips, needles, and young women in dungeons. The other lords could have accepted that. Nothing wrong with whips and needles in moderation, but the patrician apparently spent his evenings studying reports and, on special occasions, if he could stand the excitement, playing chess. He wore black a lot. It wasn't particularly impressive black, such as the best assassins wore, but the sober, slightly shabby black of a man who doesn't want to waste time in the mornings wondering what to wear. And you had to get up very early in the morning to get the better of the patrician. In fact, it was wiser not to go to bed at all. But he was popular, in a way. Under his hand, for the first time in 1,000 years, Ankh-Morpork operated. It might not be fair or just or particularly democratic, but it worked. He tended it as one tends a topiary bush, encouraging a growth here, pruning an errant twig there. It was said that he would tolerate absolutely anything apart from anything that threatened the city. And here it was. He stared at the stricken wall for a long time while the rain dripped off his chin and soaked his clothes. Behind him, Wants hovered nervously. Then one long, thin, blue-veined hand reached out, and the fingertips traced the shadows. Well, not so much shadows, more a series of silhouettes. The outline was very distinct. Inside, there was the familiar pattern of brickwork. Outside, though, something had fused the wall in a rather nice ceramic substance, giving the ancient flettons a melted mirror-like finish. The shapes outlined in brickwork showed a tableau of 6 men frozen in an attitude of surprise. Various upraised hands had quite clearly been holding knives and cutlasses. The patrician looked down silently on the pile of ash at his feet. A few streaks of molten metal might once have been the very same weapons that were now so decisively etched into the wall. He said. Captain Vimes respectfully led him across the lane and into Fast Luck Alley, where he pointed out Exhibit A, to wit. "Footprints," he said. "Which is stretching it a bit, sir. They're more what you'd call claws. One might go so far as to say talons." The patrician stared at the prints in the mud. His expression was quite unreadable. "I see," he said eventually. "And do you have an opinion about all of this, Captain?" The captain did. In the hours until dawn, he'd had all sorts of opinions, starting with the conviction that it had been a big mistake to be born. And then the grey light had filtered, even into the shades, and he was still alive and uncooked, and had looked around him with an expression of idiot relief, and seen, not a yard away, these footprints. That had not been a good moment to be sober. "Well, sir," he said, "I know that dragons have been extinct for thousands of years, sir." "Yes." The patrician's eyes narrowed. Vimes plunged on. "But, sir, the thing is, do they know? Sergeant Colon said he heard a leathery sound just before the, offence."
"So you think an extinct and indeed a possibly entirely mythical dragon flew into the city, landed in this narrow alley, incinerated a group of criminals, and then flew away?" said the patrician. "One might say it was a very public-spirited creature."
"Well, when you put it like that..."
"If I recall, the dragons of legend were solitary and rural creatures who shunned people and dwelt in forsaken, out-of-the-way places," said the patrician. "They were hardly
urban creatures?
No, sir, said the captain, repressing a comment that if you wanted to find a really forsaken and out-of-the-way place, then the Shades would fit that bill pretty well.
Besides, said Lord Vetinari, one would imagine that someone would have noticed. Wouldn't you agree?
The captain nodded at the wall and its dreadful frieze. Apart from them, you mean, sir?
In my opinion, said Lord Vetinari, it's some kind of warfare. Possibly a rival gang has hired a wizard, a little local difficulty.
Could be linked to all this strange thieving, sir, volunteered once.
But there's the footprints, sir, said Vimes doggedly.
We are close to the river, said the patrician. Possibly it was, perhaps, a wading bird of some kind. A mere coincidence, he added. But I should cover them over if I were you. We don't want people getting the wrong idea and jumping to silly conclusions, do we? He added sharply.
Vimes gave in. As you wish, sir, he said, looking at his sandals.
The patrician patted him on the shoulder. Never mind, he said. Carry on. Good show of initiative, that man. Patrolling in the shades, too. Well done.
He turned and almost walked into a wall of chainmail that was Carrot. To his horror, Captain Vimes saw his newest recruit point politely to the patrician's coach. Around it, fully armed and wary, were six members of the palace guard, who straightened up and took a wary interest. Vimes disliked them intensely. They had plumes on their helmets. He hated plumes on a guard. He heard Carrot say, "Excuse me, sir, is this your coach, sir?" And the patrician looked him blankly up and down and said, "It is. Who are you, young man?" Carrot saluted. "Lance Constable Carrot, sir."
Carrot, Carrot, that name rings a bell.
Lupin Once, who had been hovering behind him, whispered in the patrician's ear. His face brightened.
"Ah, the young thief-taker. A little error there, I think, but commendable. No person is above the law, eh?"
"No, sir," said Carrot.
"Commendable, commendable," said the patrician. "And now, gentlemen."
"About your coach, sir," said Carrot doggedly. "I couldn't help noticing that the front offside wheel, contrary to the—"
"He's going to arrest the patrician," Vimes told himself,
the thought trickling through his brain like an icy rivulet. "He's actually going to arrest the patrician, the supreme ruler. He's going to arrest him. This is what he's actually going to do. The boy doesn't know the meaning of the word fear. Oh, wouldn't it be a good idea if he knew the meaning of the word survival? And I can't get my jaw muscles to move. We're all dead, or worse, we're all detained at the patrician's pleasure, and as we all know, he's seldom that pleased." It was at this precise moment that Sergeant Colon earned himself a metaphorical medal.
"Lance Constable Carrot," he shouted. "Attention! Lance Constable Carrot, about our turn! Lance Constable Carrot, quick! March!"
Carrot brought himself to attention like a barn being raised and stared straight ahead with a ferocious expression of acute obedience. "Well done, that man," said the patrician thoughtfully, as Carrot strode stiffly away. "Carry on, Captain, and do come down heavily on any silly rumours about dragons, right?"
"Yes, sir," said Captain Vimes.
"Good man."
The coach rattled off, the bodyguard running alongside. Behind him, Captain Vimes was only vaguely aware of the sergeant yelling at the retreating Carrot to stop.
He was thinking.
He looked at the prince in the mud. He used his regulation pike, which he knew was exactly 7 feet long, to measure their size and the distance between them. He whistled under his breath. Then, with considerable caution, he followed the alley around the corner. It led to a small, padlocked and dirt-encrusted door in the back of a timber warehouse. There was something very wrong, he thought. The prince came out of the alley, but they didn't go in, and we don't often get any wading birds in the Ankh, mainly because the pollution would eat their legs away, and anyway, it's easier for them to walk on the surface. He looked up, a
myriad of washing lines crisscrossed the narrow rectangle of the sky as efficiently as a net. So, he thought, something big and fiery came out of this alley but didn't come into it, and the patrician is very worried about it. I've been told to forget about it. He noticed something else at the side of the alley and bent down and picked up a fresh, empty peanut shell. He tossed it from hand to hand, staring at nothing. Right now, he needed a drink, but perhaps it ought to wait. The librarian knuckled his way urgently along the dark aisles between the slumbering bookshelves. The rooftops of the city belonged to him. Oh, assassins and thieves might make use of them, but he'd long ago found the forests of chimneys, buttresses, gargoyles, and weather vanes a convenient and somehow comforting alternative to the streets. At least, up until now. It had seemed amusing and instructive to follow the watch into the shades, an urban jungle which held no fears for a 300-pound ape. But now the nightmare he had seen while brachiating across a dark alley would, if he had been human, have made him doubt the evidence of his own eyes. As an ape, he had no doubts whatsoever about his eyes and believed them all the time. Right now, he wanted to concentrate them urgently on a book that might hold a clue. It was in the section no one bothered with much these days. The books in there were not really magical. Dust lay accusingly on the floor. Dust with footprints in it.
"Wook!"
said the librarian in the warm gloom. He proceeded cautiously now, realizing with a sense of inevitability that the footprints seemed to have the same destination in mind as he did. He turned a corner, and there it was. The section. The bookcase. The shelf. The gap. There are many horrible sights in the multiverse. Somehow, though, to a soul attuned to the subtle rhythms of a library, there are very few worse sights than a hole where a book ought to be. Someone had stolen a book. In the privacy of the oblong office, his personal sanctum, the patrician paced up and down. He was dictating a stream of instructions. "And send some men to paint that wall," he finished. Lupin once raised an eyebrow. "Is that wise, sir?" he said. "You don't think a frieze of ghastly shadows will cause comment and speculation?" said the patrician sourly.
"Not as much as fresh paint in the shades," said Wants evenly.
The patrician hesitated a moment.
"Good point," he snapped.
"Have some men demolish it." He reached the end of the room, spun on his heel, and stalked up it again. Dragons! As if there were not enough important, enough real things to take up his time.
"Do you believe in dragons?" he said.
Wants shook his head.
"They're impossible, sir."
"So I've heard," said Lord Vetinari. He reached the opposite wall, turned.
"Would you like me to investigate further?" said Wants. "Yes, do so." "And I shall ensure the watch take great care," said Wants.
The patrician stopped his pacing.
"The watch, the watch! My dear chap, the watch are a bunch of incompetence commanded by a drunkard. It's taking me years to achieve it. The last thing we need to concern ourselves with is the watch."
He thought for a moment.
"Ever seen a dragon once? One of the big ones, I mean." "Oh, they're impossible, you said."
"They're just legend, really. Superstition," said Once.
"Hmm," said the patrician. "And the thing about legends, of course, is that they are legendary."
"Exactly, sir."
"Even so," the patrician paused and stared at Wants for some time.
"Oh, well," he said, "sort it out. I'm not having any of this dragon business. It's the type of thing that makes people restless. Put a stop to it." When he was alone, he stood and looked out gloomily over the Twin City. It was drizzling again. Ankh-Morpork, brawling city of 100,000 souls, and as the patrician privately observed, 10 times that number of actual people. The fresh rain glistened on the panorama of towers and rooftops, all unaware of the teeming, rancorous world it was dropping into. Luckier rain fell on upland sheep,
or whispered gently over forests, or pattered somewhat incestuously into the sea. Rain that fell on Ankh-Morpork, though, was rain that was in trouble. They did terrible things to water in Ankh-Morpork. Being drunk was only the start of its problem. The patrician liked to feel that he was looking out over a city that worked. Not a beautiful city, or a renowned city, or a well-drained city, and certainly not an architecturally favoured city. Even in its most enthusiastic, citizens would agree that, from a high point of vantage, Ankh-Morpork looked as though someone had tried to achieve in stone and wood, an effect normally associated with the pavements outside all-night takeaways. But it worked. It spun along cheerfully like a gyroscope on the lip of a catastrophe curve. And this, the patrician firmly believed, was because no group was ever powerful enough to push it over. Merchants, thieves, assassins, wizards all competed energetically in the race without really realizing that it needn't be a race at all, and certainly not trusting one another enough to stop and wonder who had marked out the course and was holding the starting flag. The patrician disliked the word dictator. It affronted him. He never told anyone what to do. He didn't have to. That was the wonderful part. A large part of his life consisted of arranging matters so that this state of affairs could continue. Of course, there were various groups seeking his overthrow, and this was right and proper in the sign of a vigorous and healthy society. No one could call him unreasonable about the matter. Why, hadn't he founded most of them himself? And what was so beautiful was the way in which they spent nearly all their time bickering with one another. Human nature, the patrician always said, was a marvellous thing, once you understood where its levers were. He had an unpleasant premonition about this dragon business. If ever there was a creature that didn't have any obvious levers, it was a dragon. It would have to be sorted out. The patrician didn't believe in unnecessary cruelty. He did not believe in pointless revenge. But he was a great believer in the need for things to be sorted out. Funnily enough, Captain Vimes was thinking the same thing. He found he didn't like the idea of citizens, even of the Shades, being turned into mere ceramic tint. And it had been done in front of the Watch, more or less. As if the Watch didn't matter, as if the Watch was just an irrelevant detail. That was what rankled. Of course, it was true. That only made it worse. What was making me even angrier was that he had disobeyed orders. He had scuffed up the tracks, certainly, but in the bottom drawer of his ancient desk, hidden under a pile of empty bottles, was a plaster cast. He could feel it staring at him through three layers of wood. He couldn't imagine what had got into him, and now he was going even further out onto the limb. He reviewed his, for want of a better word, troops. He asked the senior pair to turn up in plain clothes. This meant that Sergeant Colon, who'd worn uniform all his life, was looking red-faced and uncomfortable in a suit he wore for funerals, whereas Nobby... "I wonder if I made the word plain clear enough," said Captain Vimes.
"'It's what I wear outside of work, Gov," said Nobby reproachfully.
"Sir," corrected Sergeant Colon.
"My voice is in plain clothes too," said Nobby. "Initiative, that is."
Vimes walked slowly around the corporal.
"And your plain clothes do not cause old women to faint and small boys to run after you in the street," he said.
Nobby shifted uneasily. He wasn't at home with irony.
"No, sir, Gov," he said. "It's all the girl this style."
This was broadly true. There was a current fad in the Ankh for big feathered hats, ruffs, slashed doublets with gold frogging, flared pantaloons and boots with ornamental spurs. The trouble was, Vimes reflected, that most of the fashion-conscious had more body to go between these component bits, whereas all that could be said of Corporal Nobbs was that he was in there somewhere. It might be advantageous. After all, absolutely no one would ever believe when they saw him coming down the street that here was a member of the Watch trying to look inconspicuous. It occurred to Vimes that he knew absolutely nothing about Nobbs outside working hours. He couldn't even remember where the man lived. All these years he'd known the man, and he'd never realised that, in his secret private life, Corporal Nobbs was a bit of a peacock. A very short peacock, it was true. A peacock that had been hit repeatedly with something heavy, perhaps, but a peacock nonetheless. It just went to show you could never tell. He brought his attention back to the business in hand. "I want you two," he said to Nobbs and Colon, "to mingle unobtrusively, or obtrusively in your case, Corporal Nobbs, with people tonight, and see if you can detect anything unusual."
"Unusual like what?" said the sergeant.
Vimes hesitated. He wasn't exactly sure himself. "Anything," he said, "pertinent."
"Ah,"
said the sergeant. The sergeant nodded wisely.
"Pertinent. Right."
There was an awkward silence. "Maybe people have seen weird things," said Vimes. "Or perhaps there have been unexplained fires or footprints. You know," he finished desperately, "signs of dragons."
"You mean like piles of gold what have been slept on?" said the sergeant.
"And virgins being chained to rocks," said Nobbs knowingly.
"I can see you're experts," sighed Vimes. "Just do the best you can."
"It's mingling," said Sergeant Colon delicately. "It would involve going into taverns and drinking and similar, would it?"
"To a certain extent," said Vimes.
"Ah,"
said the sergeant happily. "In moderation."
"Right you are, sir."
"And at your own expense."
"Oh."
"But before you go," said the captain, "do either of you know anyone who might know anything about dragons, apart from sleeping on gold and the bit with the young women, I mean?"
"Wizards would,"
volunteered Nobby. "Apart from wizards," said Vimes firmly. "You couldn't trust wizards." Every guard knew you couldn't trust wizards. They were even worse than civilians. Colon thought about it.
"There's always Lady Ramkin," he said. "Lives in Schoon Avenue. Breeds swamp dragons, you know, the little buggers people keep as pets."
"Oh, her," said Vimes gloomily. "I think I've seen her around. The one with the Winnie if you love dragons sticker on the back of her carriage."
"That's her. She's mental," said Sergeant Colon.
"What do you want me to do, sir?" said Carrot. You have the most important job," said Vimes hurriedly. "I want you to stay here and watch the office." Carrot's face broadened in a slow, unbelieving grin.
"You mean I'm left in charge, sir?" he said.
"In a manner of speaking," said Vimes. "But you're not allowed to arrest anyone, understand?" he added quickly.
"Not even if they're breaking the law, sir?"
"Not even then. Just make a note of it." "I'll read my book then," said Carrot, "and polish my helmet." "Good boy," said the captain. It should be safe enough, he thought. No one ever comes in here, not even to report a lost dog. No one ever thinks about the watch. You'd have to be really out of touch to go to the watch for help, he thought bitterly. Schoon Avenue was a wide, tree-lined and incredibly select part of Ankh, high enough above the river to be away from its all-pervading smell. People in Schoon Avenue had old money, which was supposed to be much better than new money, although Captain Vimes had never had enough of either to spot the difference. People in Schoon Avenue had their own personal bodyguards. People in Schoon Avenue were said to be so aloof they wouldn't even talk to the gods. This was a slight slander. They would talk to the gods, if they were well-bred gods of a decent family. Lady Ramkin's house was not hard to find. It commanded an outcrop that gave it a magnificent view of the city, if that was your idea of a good time. There were stone dragons on the gatepost, and the gardens had an unkept, overgrown look. Statues of Ramkins long gone loomed up out of the greenery. Most of them had swords and were covered in ivy up to the neck. Vimes sensed that this was not because the garden's owner was too poor to do anything about it, but rather that the garden's owner thought there were much more important things than ancestors, which is a pretty unusual view for an aristocrat. They also apparently thought that there were more important things than property repair. When he rang the bell of the rather pleasant old house itself, in the middle of a flourishing rhododendron forest, several bits of plaster façade fell off. That seemed to be the only effect, except that something around the back of the house started to howl. Some things. It started to rain again. After a while, Vimes felt the dignity of his position and cautiously edged around the building, keeping well back in case anything else collapsed. He reached a heavy wooden gate in a heavy wooden wall. In contrast with the general decrepitude of the rest of the place, it seemed comparatively new and very solid. He knocked. This caused another fusillade of strange whistling noises. The door opened. Something dreadful loomed over him.
"Ah, good man, do you know anything about mating?"
it boomed. It was quiet and warm in the watch-house. Carrot listened to the hissing of sand in the hourglass and concentrated on buffing up his breastplate. Centuries of tarnish had given up under his cheerful onslaught. It gleamed. He knew where you were with a shiny breastplate. The strangeness of the city, where they had all these laws and concentrated on ignoring them, was too much for him. But a shiny breastplate was a breastplate well shined. The door opened. He peered across the top of the ancient desk. There was no one there. He tried a few more industrious rubs. There was a vague sound of someone who had got fed up with the waiting. Two purple fingernailed hands grasped the edge of the desk, and the librarian's face rose slowly into view like an early morning coconut.
"Ook!" he said.
Carrot stared. It had been explained to him carefully that, contrary to appearances, laws governing the animal kingdom did not apply to the librarian. On the other hand, the librarian himself was never very interested in obeying the laws governing the human kingdom either. He was one of those little anomalies you have to build around.
"Hello," said Carrot uncertainly.
"Don't call him boy or pat him. That always gets him annoyed." "Ook!"
The librarian prodded the desk with a long, many-jointed finger.
"What?"
"Ook!"
"Sorry?"
The librarian rolled his eyes. It was strange, he felt, that so-called intelligent dogs, horses and dolphins never had any difficulty indicating to humans the vital news of the moment. For example, that the three children were lost in the cave, or the train was about to take the line leading to the bridge that had been washed away, or similar. While he, only a handful of chromosomes away from wearing a vest, found it difficult to persuade the average human to come in out of the rain. You just couldn't talk to some people.
"Ook!"
he said, and beckoned.
"I can't leave the office," said Carrot. "I have orders."
The librarian's upper lip rolled back like a blind.
"Is that a smile?"
said Carrot. The librarian shook his head.
"Someone hasn't committed a crime, have they?"
said Carrot.
"Ook!"
"A bad crime?"
"Ook!"
"Like murder?"
"Heek!"
"Worse than murder?"
"Heek!"
The librarian knuckled over to the door and bounced up and down urgently. Carrot gulped. Orders were orders, yes, but this was something else. The people in this city were capable of anything. He buckled on his breastplate, screwed his sparkling helmet onto his head, and strode towards the door. Then he remembered his responsibilities. He went back to the desk, found a scrap of paper, and painstakingly wrote, "Out fighting crime. Please call again later. Thank you." And then he went out into the streets, untarnished and unafraid. The Supreme Grand Master raised his arms.
"Brethren," he said, "let us begin."
It was so easy. All you had to do was channel that great septic reservoir of jealousy and cringing resentment that the Brethren had in such abundance. Harness their dreadful mundane unpleasantness, which had a force greater in its way than roaring evil, and then open your own mind. Into the place where the dragons went. Vimes found himself grabbed by the arm and pulled inside. The heavy door shut behind him with a definite click.
"It's Lord Mountjoy Grayscale Talonthrust III of Ankh," said the apparition, which was dressed in a huge and fearsomely padded armour. "You know, I really don't think he can cut the mustard."
"He can't," said Vimes, backing away.
"It really needs two of you."
"It does, doesn't it?" whispered Vimes, his shoulder blades trying to carve their way out through the fence.
"Could you oblige?" boomed the thing.
"What?"
"Oh, don't be squeamish, man. You just have to help him up into the air. It's me who has to do the tricky part. I know it's cruel, but if he can't manage it tonight, then he's for the choppy-chop. Survival of the fittest and all that, don't you know?"
Captain Vimes managed to get a grip on himself. He was clearly in the presence of some sex-crazed would-be murderess, insofar as any gender could be determined under the strange lumpy garments. If it wasn't female, then reference to "it's me who has the tricky part" gave rise to mental images that would haunt him for some time to come. He knew the rich did things differently, but this was going too far.
"Madam," he said coldly, I am an officer of the watch, and I must warn you that the course of action you are suggesting breaks the laws of the city. And several of the more straight-laced gods, he added silently. And I must advise you that his lordship should be released unharmed immediately. The figure stared at him in astonishment.
Why? It said. It's my bloody dragon!
Have another drink, not Corporal Nobby?
Said Sergeant Colon unsteadily.
I do not mind if I do, not Sergeant Colon, said Nobby.
They were taking inconspicuosity seriously. That ruled out most of the taverns on the Moorpork side of the river, where they were very well known. Now they were in a rather elegant one in downtown Ankh, where they were being as unobtrusive as they knew how. The other drinkers thought they were some kind of cabaret.
I was thinking, said Sergeant Colon.
What?
If we bought a bottle or two, we could go home, and then we'd be really inconspicuous.
Nobby gave this some thought.
But he said we got to keep our ears open, he said. We are supposed to, what he said, detect anything.
We can do that at my house, said Sergeant Colon. We could listen all night really hard.
That's a good point, said Nobby.
In fact, it sounded better and better the more he thought about it.
But first, he announced, I got to pay a visit.
Me too, said the sergeant. This detecting business gets you after a while, doesn't it?
They stumbled out into the alley behind the tavern. There was a full moon up, but a few rags of scruffy cloud were drifting across it. The pair inconspicuously bumped into one another in the darkness.
Is that you, Detective Sergeant Colon? Said Nobby.
That's right. Now, can you detect the door to the privy, Detector Corporal Nobbs? We're looking for a short, dark door of mean appearance.
There were a couple of clanks and a muffled swear word from Nobby as he staggered across the alley, followed by a yowl when one of Ankh Morpork's enormous population of feral cats fled between his legs.
Who loves your pussycat? Said Nobby under his breath.
Needs must then,
said Sergeant Colon, and faced a handy corner. His private musings were interrupted by a grunt from the corporal.
You there, Sergeant?
Detector Sergeant to you, Nobby, said Colon pleasantly.
Nobby's tone was urgent and suddenly very sober.
Don't piss about, Sergeant. I just saw a dragon fly over.
I've seen a horse fly, said Sergeant Colon, hiccuping gently. And I've seen a house fly. I've even seen a green fly, but I ain't never seen a dragon fly.
Of course you have, your pillock, said Nobby urgently. Look, I'm not messing about. He had wings on him like great big wings.
Sergeant Colon turned majestically. The corporal's face had gone so white that it showed up in the darkness.
Honest, Sergeant?
Sergeant Colon turned his eyes to the damp sky and the rain-washed moon.
All right, he said. Show me.
There was a slithering noise behind him, and a couple of roof tiles smashed onto the street. He turned, and there, on the roof, was the dragon.
There's a dragon on the roof, he warbled. Nobby, there's a dragon on the roof. What shall I do, Nobby? There's a dragon on the roof. It's looking right at me, Nobby.
For a start, you could do your trousers up,
said Nobby from behind the nearest wall. Even shorn of her layers of protective clothing, Lady Sybil Ramkin was still toweringly big. Vimes knew that the barbarian Hublander folk had legends about great chain-mailed, armour-brawed, cart-horse-riding maidens, who swooped down on battlefields and carried off dead warriors on their crupper to a glorious, roistering afterlife, while singing in a pleasant mezzo-soprano. Lady Ramkin could have been one of them. She could have led them. She could have carried off a battalion. When she spoke, every word was like a hearty slap on the back and clanged with the aristocratic self-assurance of the totally well-bred. The vowel sounds alone would have cut teak. Vimes' ragged forebears were used to voices like that, usually from heavily armoured people on the back of a war charger, telling them why it would be a jolly good idea, don't you know, to charge the enemy and hit them for six. His legs wanted to stand to attention. Prehistoric men would have worshipped her, and in fact had amazingly managed to carve lifelike statues of her thousands of years ago. She had a mass of chestnut hair, a wig, Vimes learned later. No one who had much to do with dragons kept their own hair for long. She also had a dragon on her shoulder. It had been introduced as Talonthrust Vincent Wonderkind of Quirm, referred to as Vinny, and seemed to be making a large contribution to the unusual chemical smell that pervaded the house. This smell permeated everything. Even the generous slice of cake she offered him tasted of it. The shoulder. It looks very nice, he said, desperate to make conversation.
Rubbish, said her ladyship. I'm just training him up because shoulder sitters fetch twice the price.
Vimes murmured that he had occasionally seen society ladies with small colourful dragons on their shoulders, and thought it looked very nice.
Oh, it sounds nice, she said. I'll grant you. Then they realise it means soot burns, frizzled hair, and crapple down their back. Those talons dig in too. And they think the thing's getting too big and smelly, and the next thing you know, it's either down to Moorpork Sunshine Sanctuary for lost dragons, or the old heave-ho into the river with a rope around your neck. Poor little buggers.
She sat down, arranging a skirt that could have made sails for a small fleet.
Now then, Captain Vimes, was it?
Vimes was at a loss. Ramkins, long dead, stared down at him from ornate frames on the shadowy walls. Between, around and under the portraits were the weapons they'd presumably used, and had used well and often by the look of them. Suits of armour stood in dented ranks along the walls. Quite a number, he couldn't help noticing, had large holes in them. The ceiling was a faded riot of moth-eaten banners. You did not need forensic examination to understand that Lady Ramkin's ancestors had never shirked a fight. It was amazing that she was capable of doing something so unwarlike as having a cup of tea.
"My forebears," she said, following his hypnotized gaze, "you know not one Ramkin in the last 1,000 years has died in his bed."
"Yes, ma'am."
"So was a family pride, that?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Quite a few of them have died in other people's, of course."
Captain Vimes's teacup rattled in its saucer.
"Yes, ma'am," he said.
"Captain is such a dashing title, I've always thought." She gave him a bright, brittle smile. "I mean, colonels and so on are so stuffy, majors are pompous, but one always feels somehow that there is something delightfully dangerous about a captain. What was it you had to show me?"
Vimes gripped his parcel like a chastity belt.
"I wondered," he faltered, "how big swamp...
He stopped. Something dreadful was happening to his lower regions. Lady Ramkin followed his gaze.
"Oh, take no notice of him," she said cheerfully. "Hit him with a cushion if he's a bother."
A small elderly dragon had crawled out from under his chair and placed its jowly muzzle in Vimes's lap. It stared up at him soulfully with big brown eyes and gently dribbled something quite corrosive, by the feel of it, over his knees. And it stank like the ring around an acid bath.
"That's Dewdrop Maybelline Talonthrust the First," said her ladyship. "Champion and sire of champions. No fire left now, poor soppy old thing. He likes his belly rubbed."
Vimes made surreptitiously vicious jerking motions to dislodge the old dragon. It blinked mournfully at him with rheumy eyes and rolled back the corner of its mouth, exposing a picket fence of soot-blackened teeth.
"Just push him off if he's a nuisance," said Lady Rankin cheerfully. "Now then, what was it you were asking?"
"I was wondering how big swamp dragons grow," said Vimes, trying to shift position. There was a faint, growling noise.
"You came all the way up here to ask me that? Well, I seem to recall Greyheart Talonthrust of Ang stood 14 thumbs high. Toe to matlock," mused Lady Ramkin. "About 3 foot 6 inches," she said kindly.
"No bigger than that," said Vimes hopefully. In his lap the old dragon began to snore gently.
"Golly, no, he was a bit of a freak, actually. Mostly they don't get much bigger than 8 thumbs.
Captain Vimes's lips moved in hurried calculation.
2 feet, he ventured.
"Well done. That's the cobs, of course. The hens are a bit smaller."
Captain Vimes wasn't going to give in.
"A cob would be a male dragon," he said.
"Only after the age of 2 years," said Lady Ramkin triumphantly. "Up to the age of 8 months he's a pumet. Then he's a cock until 14 months, and then he's a snood."
Captain Vimes sat entranced, eating the horrible cake, breeches gradually dissolving, as the stream of information flooded over him. How the males fought with flame, but in the laying season, only the hens breathed fire. From the combustion of complex intestinal gases to incubate the eggs, which needed such a fierce temperature. While the males gathered firewood, a group of swamp dragons was a slump, or an embarrassment. A female was capable of laying up to 3 clutches of 4 eggs every year, most of which were trodden on by absent-minded males, and that dragons of both sexes were vaguely uninterested in one another, and indeed everything except firewood, except for about once every 2 months, when they became as single-minded as a buzzsaw. He was helpless to prevent himself being taken out to the kennels at the back, outfitted from neck to ankle in leather armour faced with steel plates, and ushered into the long low building where the whistling had come from. The temperature was terrible, but not as bad as the cocktail of smells. He staggered aimlessly from one metal-lined pen to another, while pear-shaped, squeaking little horrors with red eyes were introduced as Moonpenny Duchess Marchpane, who's gravid at the moment, and Moonmist Talonthrust II, who was best of breed at Pseudopolis last year. Jets, a pale green flame, played across his knees. Many of the stalls had rosettes and certificates pinned over them.
"And this one, I'm afraid, is Good Boy Bindle Featherstone of Quirm," said Lady Ramkin relentlessly.
Vimes stared groggily over the charred barrier at the small creature curled up in the middle of the floor. It bore about the same resemblance to the rest of them as Nobby did to the average human being. Something in his ancestry had given it a pair of eyebrows that were about the same size as its stubby wings, which could never have supported it in the air. Its head was the wrong shape, like an anteater. It had nostrils like jet intakes. If it ever managed to get airborne, the thing would have the drag of twin parachutes. It was also turning on Captain Vimes the most silently intelligent look he'd ever had from any animal, including Corporal Nobbs.
"It happens," said Lady Ramkin sadly. "It's all down to genes, you know."
"It is," said Vimes. Somehow the creature seemed to be concentrating all the power its siblings wasted in flame and noise into a stare like a thermic lance. He couldn't help remembering how much he'd wanted a puppy when he was a little boy. Mind you, they'd been starving. Anything with meat on it would have done. He heard the dragon lady say,
"One tries to breed for a good flame, depth of scale, correct colour, and so on. One just has to put up with the occasional total whittle."
The little dragon turned on Vimes a gaze that would be guaranteed to win it the award for the dragon the judges would most like to take home and use as a portable gaslighter. Total whittle, Vimes thought. He wasn't sure of the precise meaning of the word, but he could hazard a shrewd guess. It sounded like whatever it was you had left when you had extracted everything of any value whatsoever. Like the watch, he thought. Total whittles, every one of them. And just like him. It was the saga of his life.
"That's nature for you," said her ladyship. "Of course, I wouldn't dream of breeding from him, but he wouldn't be able to anyway."
"Why not?" said Vimes.
"Because dragons have to mate in the air, and he'll never be able to fly with those wings, I'm afraid. I'll be sorry to lose the bloodline, naturally. His sire was Brenda Rodley's Tree-Bite Brightscale. Do you know Brenda?"
No, said Vimes. Lady Ramkin was one of those people who assumed that everyone else knew everyone one knew.
"Charming girl. Anyway, his brothers and sisters are shaping up very well."
"Poor little bastard," thought Vimes. "That's nature for you in a nutshell. Always dealing off the bottom of the pack. No wonder they called her a mother."
"You said you had something to show me," Lady Ramkin prompted.
Vimes wordlessly handed her the parcel. She slipped off her heavy mittens and unwrapped it.
"Plaster cast of a footprint," she said boldly. "Well?"
"Does it remind you of anything?" said Vimes.
"Could be a wading bird."
"Oh." Vimes was crestfallen. Lady Ramkin laughed.
"Oh, really big dragon. Got it out of a museum, did you?"
"No, I got it off the street this morning."
"Ha! Someone's been playing tricks on you, old chap."
There was, circumstantial evidence," he told her. She stared at him.
"Draco Nobilis," she said hoarsely.
"Pardon?" said Vimes.
"Draco Nobilis, the noble dragon, as opposed to these fellows." She waved a hand in the direction of the massed ranks of Whistling Lizard,
Draco Vulgaris, the lot of them. But the big ones are all gone, you know. This really is nonsense. No two ways about it, all gone. Beautiful things they were. Weighed tons, biggest things ever to fly. No one knows how they did it. And then they realized. It was suddenly very quiet. All along the rows of kennels, the dragons were silent, bright-eyed, and watchful. They were staring at the roof.